Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned, and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. So, yeah, there's so many interesting things in your story. I guess it kind of makes sense to start with your story from like the kinder transport and getting out of Germany.
Yeah, it's not just that it was the start, but it was actually been the driving force of the whole of my long life. We were born in North Germany. My father was a judge. And he lost his job completely in 1933, the year that I was born. So things started to be difficult at that stage. And we finished up in Vienna, which was my mother's home city. And my parents did a really very brave thing. They organized for me to come out of Nazi Europe and sent me to England into the arms of strangers. They had a name and address. Said goodbye to us, thinking never to see us again. I say us because I was with my older sister. I was 5 years old, she was nine. And if you think how small a five-year-old is, I sort of think to send a five-year-old away, it was a horrendous journey, 2.5 days. The train was apparently about 1,000 children aged 5 to 16. And we slept on rolls of corrugated cardboard. I don't know what we ate, but there were only 2 adults for those 1,000 children. Plus some young girls who were looking after some babies. And I always like to mention them because they were young. And I think courage is, you know, doubly special from a young person. They were traveling under a concession where they had agreed they could bring these babies out as long as they returned to what they must have known, Sam, was almost certain death. And the one I know of, as a person, I never met her. She made 2 such journeys of love and brought out some babies. So it was a horrendous thing. And once we got to England, we were with a new country, new language, new food, new parents. Mm. And that's a change in your lifestyle, a change in your mindset, I think, that took a long time to assimilate, but has absolutely driven the rest of my life.
So it's driven you to be more bold, or is it sort of the effects of afterwards and kind of realizing like the value of your life and what to do with it?
I think that the enormous change, having got through that, I know that nothing really can be as bad as that again. Mm. And so I do have more confidence of my ability to cope with things. I also realized that having gone through those changes and I can deal with change, I've learned to enjoy change. Mm. So I like doing new things. I like making new things happen. And that's very useful to me in the digital world. And also I got very early on as a child, this feeling that I needed to justify that what my life was safe. And that's not a healthy feeling to have. But I did have it, and so I try, and still try, not to fritter my life away, but to justify my existence and cope with that survivor guilt. Why should I survive when so many children died among the 6 million people who were lost generally? I came across a figure very recently, which was new to me and maybe new to you. 6 million Jews were killed during the Holocaust, of which 1 million were children. But I came across that there were about another 5 million non-Jews who were gypsies, communists. Mm. I had no idea that there were so many.
It's bad to sort of feel ownership of the guilt, but in some ways it's very good to value your life in that sense. And technically speaking, it's almost impossible that any of us exist, and we should like really value the fact that we even exist at all, whether or not like other people got killed or not. It's sort of, it's still almost impossible that you're here.
Yes, it's an individual thing. So, but it was 6 years of analysis to get me out of that dreadful slough of despond, because I was severely depressed. Oh. I felt rejected. If survivor guilt and depression has any solution. It is compassion. And since I've been working as a philanthropist, giving away the money that I've made myself, I've really turned into quite a happy person. Basically, I have a very positive, happy disposition these days.
Yeah, that's really important. Yeah, how did you go about realizing that you needed to seek help, or was it sort of sought for you?
I was a young woman. I started working at the age of 18, and a colleague who became actually an ex-lover knew me well enough to sort of say, I think you could do with some help. And he had had experience, and he introduced me to the Tavistock Clinic. And this was before the days of the National Health Service, and it was amazing, 6 years of treatment, and I never paid a penny. It turned out that the analyst, a guy called H.E. Israel, I know nothing more about him, was a Kleinian analyst. And all he apparently did was sit quietly and listen in a very, very positive way. And it worked. But again, I think I was lucky to get there. Some people's trauma is so strong that it goes on to the second generation, that they somehow bring their children up in a very protective way and not a terribly healthy way, and they don't talk about what's happened to them. I certainly know that when my son was a baby and my husband wanted to have him circumcised for health reasons, my reaction was absolutely immediate. No, no, no. That would mark him as a Jew. It really did make so much difference.
Crazy thing to go through, isn't it? Certainly compared to, I mean, we're going through some terrible things at the moment, but it's the scale of it is not really the same.
I think it's interesting. It is worldwide. It's not just Germany, Europe, and Italy, you know, when is America going to come in and all those sorts of questions that we had. But it is really worldwide, and it makes one think of solutions that there also need to be global solutions. We can do a certain amount here, but obviously much of it needs to be done on a global basis.
Yeah, there's no like sort of specific front line exactly. Sort of it's kind of everywhere in every country and every human can be affected by it kind of thing, which is, so it's a very strange moment. Yes. That the whole world sort of stopping and pausing and experiencing the same thing.
I think it's strange that we're working from home, which I have always done since the age of 30, and I have really learned to have systems that allow some division between home life and business life. Whenever you ask women what they want from their employer, they always come up with the same two things. They want flexibility and they want home-life balance. And my company, which I set up for women, was flexible to the extreme. And we certainly allowed home-life balance. Not everybody managed it. Not everybody is able to work from home. How are you finding it?
I've been working from home for like the last 10 years on and off anyway. So it's not, but I mean, I kind of grew up with email and computers and stuff. What I find nuts is that you did this in the 60s when no one had ever heard of remote working and you couldn't just email people anything. And I'm still baffled how that worked.
Even the simple telephone, we used to ask applicants, not do you have a telephone, what's your number, but do you have access to a telephone? So not everybody did. And we sort of said, unless you have access to a telephone, you can't work with us.
Wow. That's kind of nuts. So how did you, because this is a software company, and that it's just, how did you write software without something to write software on?
Well, we started off with developing paper and pencil, writing flow charts, really defining the task to be done in a very detailed sort of way. And we then coded it, usually in machine code, but sometimes in binary, which was then sent to a third-party service who punched it onto card or paper tape, and then that was repunched in order to verify it, and all that prior to actually going onto the computer proper. And we would book computer time by the minute. I want 3 minutes this evening, I want 2 minutes tomorrow morning. And it was very expensive, so your stomach was all churning, you know, can I get through in 3 minutes and so on. But it was a very exciting time, and our schedules were based on two such turnarounds a week. And I used something called a supercomputer, which had about the power of my Apple Watch. And it was an enormous thing. You know? very, very impressive. They were good times. And I mean, I was very lucky, Sam, because had I been 10 years earlier in the business, I wouldn't have been a so-called success. And if I'd been 10 years later, I wouldn't have been. But I was just at the beginning of that growth curve where people, I mean, I was a mathematician, so and you needed maths in those days. But I could really join this virgin society. Very, very exciting.
Yeah, it must have been amazing to be innovating, that kind of thing. It sounds like a crazy time to be working on things and sort of, you sort of, we've just taken so much stuff for granted that we have now.
There's always innovation. I mean, at the moment I'm not involved, but I know other people are doing this exciting work on artificial intelligence and virtual reality. There's a really exciting work going on, which young people, new people can come in. And very often innovation comes not from people who know a great deal, but people who know a great deal and have experience of something else.
But yeah, so like on the remote side of things, like how did you go around finding business and getting your name out there if you're based from home?
Well, the original work came from ex-colleagues and my ex-employer, fairly natural. And once we got through two or three tasks like that, you sort of suddenly realise where is the work going to come from? And I had to learn to actually market and I had to learn to sell. And when I started off selling, I thought I had to show off my technical expertise. But of course, selling isn't like that at all. It's much more about listening to potential customers, listening really hard, and then making sure that your offer matches their needs expressed or implied. So it was a very slow growth curve. For example, when I started my company, I had been earning £2,000 a year, which was a very high salary for a mere woman. Now, in the first year in my business, we earned, as a company, £700. The next one was £1,700, then £27, then £37. We had all those sevens, which is why I could remember them. But it was basically, what I'm saying is very, very slow. And that meant we actually developed some very sound processes, which stood us in good stead. One of our very first contracts was with a management consultancy where we were paid to develop software standards of management control protocols. And that meant that we had access to those very sophisticated methods ourselves. We even paid to update them over the years. And so we started off with the tools of being very professional about software, which at that time was highly creative and quite unstructured, you know. It'll be ready next week. I've only got three more bugs to get out and so on. And next week, more bugs to get out. I mean, it was really quite strange. But that was one of the reasons for our success. I think the other was to do with the fact that we were all home-based and part-time and female. And I needed to disguise that somewhat from our professional clients. And so we moved to fixed price, one of the very first people to use fixed price for software. And that disguised the whole lot. So we had to actually have sufficient experience of writing software to be able to break things down to what we called work parcels, none of which was bigger than something we'd successfully done before. And in that way, we gradually got to from tiny little contracts. Towards the end, we were doing software contracts of half a billion, and that takes some doing.
Yeah, so you said you needed to disguise the fact that people were female. Why and how?
Why? Because women were at that time very much classed as second-class citizens. They were not considered anything. Programming software came out of the clerical industry. And so a lot of it was considered to be low-level routine work, which the men didn't want to do. And in the 60s, that began to change as the men realized how very high paid it was and how interesting it was as well. The other reason was that there were many, many women who had left full-time work on marriage or when their first child was expected and had therefore been at home, domestic responsibilities, childcare, And they leapt at the opportunity of doing professional work in their own time, in their own homes, at a high level. So I had access to a workforce in very short supply. And it remained all female for 13 years, I think, when in 1975, equal opportunities legislation came in this country. And so it was illegal to have a policy of employing women. And so we began to employ the men as well.
But it's a nice thing to have, as in, I guess, that's when the rest of the workforces would be perhaps employing more women. So it makes sense that you employ more men. But yeah, what do you think about, like, in the current feminism movements, which have gone in kind of waves, and then still more stuff to go?
Are you thinking about the Me Too movement?
Not so much. More just like the general, like, ways that we can still make society more equal, and what we're kind of missing out by not doing it, perhaps.
I think business is really starting to understand that diversity leads to innovation. And what happens in business at the moment is innovation. And some of the diverse sectors of the workforce, in particular people with autism, are highly innovative. And you also know that if you have a team that is mixed, they come up with solutions that are really new. So there is a move to measure diversity in the workforce, measure diversity, or in particular women, on corporate boards. And that has had some success. The first country to have really a drive to get women onto boards of directors was Norway. And they aim to get 30%, I think, of their board members female, which they achieved. Takes time. Gives us another 400 years.
Let's say we can do it quicker than that. As in, yeah, we're in a time of radical change right now. Maybe some things happen that are different.
Do you think that the world will go back to how it was before the end of this lockdown?
It's nice to see the other side of things, because we've lived in this, like, reality as it is, to realize that suddenly the whole thing can be broken and we can live in a completely different way. Like, everyone can stop all of these things that drive the economy and are ruining the planet.
With the environmental issues, at the moment our rivers are nice and clean, the air quality is better. You know, a lot of things that we've been saying we want from society for some time, and we didn't know how to get it. I know so many people who are seriously worried. They've lost their job, and that gives a pressure that might stimulate innovation. A lot of people will go into business on their own account.
Yeah, so it's potentially a breeding ground for innovation and good new things to happen, but it's also a driver to get back to normal as quickly as possible and try and stimulate anything that will make more money, such as, like, the travel industry and things that we didn't really need.
One of the very positive things that have come out was that for the first time, Britain has said we're going to get people off the streets and into proper accommodation. And we've been talking about this forever and a day, but now it's actually happened. Why now? It's not as if, you know, suddenly accommodation has become free, but we've made it happen now because people are actually thinking of each other rather than me, me, me. We've become very selfish with years, almost a generation, of easy living.
Yeah, I certainly think, like, a lot of stuff won't get instantly forgotten in terms of we suddenly appreciate human connection a lot more and recognize our neighbors. And certainly my friends that are still living in streets, they're all suddenly got to know everyone they live near, because in London you have no clue who lives on your street, but suddenly everyone's in, like, a big WhatsApp group or a Facebook group of people that happen to live next to you, and, like, you sort of, you just look out for each other a lot more, and it's kind of cute. So it's certainly a bonding
thing. Certainly older people like me are getting lots and lots of phone calls, people just basically checking, are you managing all right, anything we can do. Really very nice to know. You learn who your friends are, and these are friends, basically. I'm sufficiently active and mobile that I'm offering help to some of my neighbours who are.
Yeah, you shouldn't be going out.
Yeah.
I'd be hearing that. But yeah, it's certainly positive on that side. But yeah, there's sort of more global, I don't know how many things will change or not. And it was in, like, they've already cancelled the Copenhagen 22 talks this year for climate So why can't it just happen virtually anyway? As in, it's not until November. Can't they just all dial in, like all the governments
doing that? They'll do something like that, yes.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see. What do you think, like, the most important, like, thing that we can try and change for when we put society back together?
Well, being a software person, I do believe that in the big changes that are incipient in artificial intelligence, I know people are scared of it, and it will make a lot of changes itself in how society works. I used to think that, well, of course, there's nothing to be scared of there because artificial intelligence, the machine will only do what the programmer has, what I've told it to do. Mm. But AI has actually moved on from that.
Yeah.
And is coming up with solutions that are very interesting. It's also coming up with dangers like false news and so on, where we really don't know where information comes from anymore. The rate of change has never been so fast. And yet, you know, in a way, it'll never be as slow again because it's accelerating all the time.
Yeah, but what do you think we should do with the technology if there was something we could, like, aim for?
I would aim for world peace and the end of national boundaries. I do think at the moment.
Yes.
people are starting to think, well, this is a global problem. Perhaps we should go for a global solution. A lot of things are global, in particular the environment. And if we can start working globally, but it is a bit of an idealist and most sophisticated people just laugh at me.
Yeah. But I mean, I certainly agree. And like, viruses don't care how rich you are or which
body
you belong to. It's sort of, it's a species problem. It's not who you are or where you are. And the same with the environment. And it's going to be a bit different. Like, some places will be more inhabitable than others and things if stuff goes really badly wrong. But still, the effects of people, like, see, migrating from different parts is still going to impact everyone.
I think there's plenty of opportunity in space. I mean, in the 50s, I joined something called the Interplanetary Society, where we were starting to think of getting out of the Earth's atmosphere. It was at that level. Well, now people like Branson are talking about populating other parts of space. I mean, these are exciting things that are within one's comprehension that they might happen, not certainly not in my lifetime, but perhaps in yours.
It's certainly really interesting. As in terms of the world now, it's much harder to be like an explorer, and there's no piece of land you can go and find that hasn't been reached by many people, kind of thing. And but I mean, if you take a step back and think of like the general insignificance of your life in terms of number of people, being like the first people to colonize Mars is like hugely amazing compared to, well, I sat at home and didn't do too much. It was slightly nicer and easier, but actually it could have done this crazy epic thing. It's like, yeah, I guess on that side of things it makes sense.
I think going back to my own motivation, I want the world to be a fairer place. And certainly for women and for autistic people, I have helped to make it a more fair place. Because at the moment, there is this extraordinary division between the rich and the poor. And I'm not just only talking in financial terms, but in health terms and others. Mm. So I think you and I could put the world to rights if we had enough time. Yeah. One of the things that you asked in your mindset concept, which is interesting, and I sort of thought about it knowing we were going to speak, and I've decided that mine is a learning mindset. I try not to make the same mistakes that I did before. I try always to do new things. In my philanthropy, I only support pioneering projects that, no matter how worthy, they really have to be pioneering and they have to be strategic. So I'm always trying to do things better than I did last week or last year. And that gives me enormous satisfaction. People think with my Jewish background that I might be have a really strong faith, but I don't. I try to lead a spiritual life, by which I mean the non-material aspects of life, you know, and I'm talking about friendship and love and nature, art. I'm very keen on modern art.
Interesting to hear your thoughts. And also, I guess you've also been very good at dealing with things like letting go of your business and losing money and stuff, which a lot of people might be going through at the moment. and sort of how you came to terms with these kind of things would be interesting.
When I talked about trying to lead a spiritual life, the title of my memoir is Let It Go, and that's a Buddhist concept of making sure that the rancor of the past doesn't ruin the present and tomorrow. And that really has stood me in good stead to leave things behind, to not bear grudges, to continue always with goodwill. And many of the spiritual aspects of life are concerned with other people and are open to misinterpretation, so things can go wrong. But basically, I work almost quite hard to keep me as a sort of three-quarters full glass. I'm a three-quarters full glass person. I do see the best side of people. I try to ignore the weaknesses. And certainly as a manager, I have been like that for 30 years. But when I started, I was very much do this, do that, because I felt that I knew how to do things better than anybody else, and I would show them how to do it. But now I get on much better by listening to other people. And I had the experience in my second job working under Tommy Flowers of Bletchley Park coding fame. And he was a superb, inspirational people manager. He wasn't a mentor. I only just knew him. But he certainly inspired me. As you know, you could become a manager. And my company got very big eventually, without turning into a money person, without turning into a big fat boss.
And a lot of useful points there. Certainly I found trying to get the best out of people. It's a funny one when you kind of want to point out their mistakes and how they can do better, but it's better to kind of try and just be positive
this
and
is good.
To do
this
more
is good.
The whole way kind of thing.
Yes. Took me a long time to learn that.
Yeah. Try and be like, okay, well, you're really good at all of these things. You could do like two things maybe better and just like the few things that will motivate them to try a bit harder on something that they will do, rather than just like laying everything, oh, this was wrong, this was wrong, this was wrong, this was wrong. And yeah, it's a hard one.
I like to hear sort of when I was in my company still, you know, roars of laughter as I walked down a corridor. So people having a good time. We should enjoy work. Work shouldn't be something that we do when we'd rather be doing something else.
Definitely, which is a sad thing that it sort of feels synonymous with trading your time for doing something you don't want to be doing, when it's like, it's the chance to, I mean, yeah. As a concept, that's never really made sense to me in terms of your life should be something that you want to be doing. Anything else you might want to cover in terms of all of your recent work that's kind of defined your life on autism that we haven't really touched on at all?
Well, one of the IT projects that I was the initial funder, it was not my idea, was the Oxford Internet Institute. Mm. And when I was talking about false news, I mean, they're currently working. I mean, it's quite an established interdisciplinary part of Oxford University now. But it's looking at the social, economic, legal and ethical aspects of life online. And I think that's very relevant for the current time. And they are certainly working to find out techniques from where, that if you get a message, you can actually find out where it comes from, because there's this lovely expression, astroturfing, meaning that an advertising message goes out deliberately designed to look like a grassroots message from the public, and it isn't, it's a straight advertising, hence the term astroturfing. So these are the sort of things that in the IT world I still touch on, because I follow what the Oxford Internet Institute does. On the autism side, I think things have moved on a great deal. People are beginning to realize that people with autism, it's a brain disorder. They see the world in a completely different way, and they are very innovative for that reason. It used to be considered to be a disability, something that you had to try and improve, something that you would like to cure, and that people with autism should behave as you and I do. In fact, we've now moved to a society in which we need to understand how people with autism work, and we need to change in order to reach out to this 1 in 100 people are involved with autism. It's not insignificant. And really cherish the differences rather than sort of saying they have a disability, we're not bothered.
Yeah, it's a really good way of fundamentally changing the way we look at it to actually be much more sensible. So really interesting. Nice. So the work that you're supporting, are they working to make that happen, or are they kind of treating people with autism in that way? And is there like a public agenda for making this happen?
Well, one of my charities is Autistica, which funds medical research into autism. And they have fund, for example, I think 45 different researchers, mainly in the UK. There's a little bit of work going on in the States, I think. But the big change is on the society side for autistic people to lead longer, healthier, happier lives. And that really brings home what I think every human being should be doing, and that is concentrating on the quality of life, not the material quality, but the intellectual and emotional quality of happy lives.
It's good to hear these things are going on. Yeah, so it must be really nice to reach a point where you can kind of just focus on philanthropy and changing the world for the better.
Most people my age are thinking, what should we do today? Get back the current lockdown. But I always have something to get up for each morning. One of the things I'm looking forward to, I thought it was going to be this year, but probably it'll be deferred till next year, is that they're making a film of the book of Let It Go. As far as having a director and a producer and talking about who's going to play me. And I think, it should be such fun to see that interpretation.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes.
It's going to be amazing. Looking forward to that. It's a really interesting book. Very well written. It's got some great quotes in it.
I think most people are surprised how honest I was in writing it. I always make the distinction between an autobiography and a memoir. An autobiography would say on Thursday the 3rd of April that such and such happened and it was raining, whereas a memoir is much more concerned with the things that I consider to be important and how I remember them. Obviously, I check most things, especially names and so on. But, you know, there was lots of years which are not mentioned at all. How did you react to the section on my son? Because most people found that pretty difficult.
Yeah, I found the conversation about you considering hanging yourself plus your son and your husband, from the beginning, be like, oh, wow, that's a huge thing to admit to. But you sort of, you can see why you might be thinking these things when life's just really hard. And so like it's one of those weird things that your brain just does naturally anyway. It just explores options, and then normally you just go, that's a silly option, you never think about it. But like when you're in that sort of scenario, it kind of hangs around for longer. I mean, like every time you pick up a knife, well, if I'm near someone, it goes through my brain that I could stab someone, but then I don't. So yeah, I found that really, really fascinating. And certainly it helps you understand, because when you read about autism, you think about the problem for the person with it, and that is probably hard to deal with, but you don't really understand.
The psychologists have said that the families of, especially the prime carer, who's usually the mother of an autistic child, has as much stress as a combat soldier.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, sounds
sexy in context, doesn't it?
But I mean, in some ways it might be as much stress, but in some ways it's worse, because if you choose to go into combat as a soldier because you kind of trained to do that thing and you signed up to do that, whereas you didn't sign up to have a son with autism. You kind of, that was like what life gave you.
Yeah. It took me into areas that are quite different. Quite different.
Yeah.
Where are you going in your life, Sam?
Yeah, I've had an interesting, like the past 10 years in terms of gaining lots of different skills like coding. I've traveled the world a lot. I've been to like North Korea, I've hitchhiked across Kazakhstan. So I've tried to, I've been very anthropologist-y. I lived in Mexico for a while, and I've really liked getting involved in different things and understanding the world at a bigger level. But I mean, I'm really inspired by people like you and Bill Gates that have made lots of money, been able to do like big things in the world in terms of changing it. So I kind of want to start like a tech business that fundamentally does good in the world, but makes money that then allows me to do.
That's what a social business is all about.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of what I'm working on at the moment. I'm building in an app for podcasting. It's kind of like a bit more of a social network, so you can listen with your friends at the same time, or kind of in sync, kind of like being in a book club. So that you could kind of catch up with each other and you still have something like a reason to talk about these things, because you learn a lot more by talking with humans about what you've listened to. Because of currently when you listen to podcasts, it's all by yourself. So it's a bit of an isolated sort of silo of your phone when you could be doing it with others. So I'm kind of building that at the moment, which I feel
Sounds good.
Catches the moment a bit and helps people with like the loneliness and isolation at the moment. So I'm hoping that works. Otherwise, I'll start another idea. And I've got a few other, I wanted to build an app that lets you track things over time in terms with images. So you can kind of like still motion capture like your garden or something, but you can do it of any kind of health thing that you're unsure about. So like if you have like a weird spot and it grows or something, but it would also have cancer detection built into it for skin cancers. So that's another thing that I kind of want to do. And I thought of like a kind of fun publicity thing for it in terms of interviewing people. Have you heard of the song Wear Sunscreen?
No.
Okay, it was like number one in the 90s. And it's basically this really famous speech, which each line is just like very quotable. And I was just going to get famous people to kind of tell a story behind the quote of why you should have do some of the things behind it. So I kind of thought about quite a lot of ways into that. So those are a few things I'm keen to do. And I'm generally just trying to work on my public ability to do these things. So I did my first TEDx a few weeks ago and been doing a lot of...
I'm afraid I haven't seen that actually, which I should have done.
Oh, no, it hasn't been released. It should be released like next week, maybe. We'll see. So I'm trying to like use my public voice, regardless of my ability to make a business happen or not, as much as possible whilst I'm growing and learning.
Presumably the Mindset podcast really takes your voice out to where you want it to go.
Yeah, it's really make a name for me and like getting to do speaking and have a bit of a handle on changing things, which is really nice. And yeah, being able to have like conversations with people like you is also amazing. So I feel incredibly lucky already, which is good. But yeah, certainly lots of things I want to still be doing and working towards, and writing my own book as well. And all
well, that. I wish you good fortune.
Yeah, thanks.
I wish you good in doing that.
Cheers. But yeah, I guess like the final few questions that you had would be good. Just the what is the kindest thing someone's done for you?
My lovely foster parents who kindly took me into their home in 1939 and into their hearts. It is the most kindest thing that you could possibly do to offer a refugee child a home and love and future.
Hopefully we don't need to do that too much, but it's very possible that there are a lot of refugees and things. So that's a huge thing to take on.
Well, I wish you well in your career.
Thank you very much. And I'm really looking forward to the movie and I hope everything goes well in the next year and so. And don't go out. Regardless of if people need help, stay safe.
Take care. Stay safe. Stay at home. Good. Exactly. Very nice to meet you. Enjoyed
it. All right.
Bye.
Ciao.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.